To badquaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Monday, October 22nd, 2012, and this is podcast number 216. You know, it's an odd thing. Two of the past four weeks have been mostly reruns on this podcast, or no podcast at all. My dad fell ill 4 or 5 weeks ago, and so I took a week off and spent some time with him. He was hospitalized with heart problems, and he was looking much better, and he was doing really well. And so I came back home, and I did some podcasting and so forth. And then we got a call 1 week ago yesterday that he had died in his sleep. He had been doing much better. He was doing really well. And then he just, it just happens that way sometimes. And I thought about doing a whole podcast today just talking about my dad, but I think I'll do that another time perhaps. But, in many ways, you know, he lived a very full life. He lived an amazingly full life. And he had a very realistic view of life and death. It's one of the things that I'm really happy that I inherited from him. Well, I didn't really inherit it. I learned it from him. I learned it from his example. And, he had a very realistic outlook on life and death. And so, you know, at any point in time, whether we're talking 10 years ago, 30 years ago, or last week, he was prepared for death, not only of himself, but of other loved ones and so forth. Sometimes people, when a close family member like my mother died some years back, and sometimes people would see his reaction to deaths of close family members, and they would think maybe that he was hard-hearted or that he didn't have emotions or something. But that was really a mistranslation of what was really taking place with my dad. It wasn't that he was hard, or it wasn't that he was, you know, emotionless or anything like that. He was very, very full of emotions. And he wasn't hard at all. Many times he would give you the impression that he was very, very hard. And in some ways, you know, he was old time hard, in his toughness. But in other ways, he was really, really soft. But in the case of life and death, he had such a realistic view. He knew, he understood deeply in his soul that everything that lives dies, and that our only guarantee in life is the last breath that we just took. We don't have any guarantee at all on the next breath. And he understood this from early, early years. You know, I said I wasn't going to do a big thing on him, but I do want to mention this. One of the stories of my dad involves when he was 9 years old, he and some friends, and I won't do the whole story. I mean, I have this story, and I'm not going to do the whole story. I'm just going to touch on it. When he was 9 years old, he and some family and some friends that were about his age were all out in the woods in eastern Kentucky, and there was an old log cabin that had been abandoned that they stumbled upon. And in it, they found a brass cup that had three dynamite blasting caps. These are the caps that slide over the end of a stick of dynamite that ignite the dynamite. So they're, you know, commonly called blasting caps, but anyway, each one of them has, something like a quarter of the strength of a stick of dynamite, something like that. Maybe not exactly that, but And, but anyway, to my father, they looked like old, black powder shotgun shells, because this was the 1920s and, or no, let's see. Yeah, it would have been, right around 1930, perhaps. But anyway, to him, they looked like, because he'd never actually seen blasting caps before, but he had seen, black powder shotgun shells. So they looked like black powder shotgun shells. And black powder shotgun shells, even after you shoot them, even after they're expended, you can put a match down in there, and because black powder burns very inefficiently, there's often a little bit of black powder residue left in there, and it'll give you a quick little flash. That's pretty harmless, but for a kid in the 1930s, 1920s, that would be a fun thing to do. So he was holding this brass cup in his left hand, and with the three dynamite caps in there, and he put a match down in there to get that flash effect that he expected from black powder shotgun shells. And the blast of the three dynamite caps took most of his hand off. It turned the brass cup into shrapnel and put chunks of it throughout all the kids that were there in the cabin with him, including in my dad's all across my dad's chest and in his face. Almost took one of his eyes out completely. And he was miles away from home, you know, way off in the hills of Kentucky. And all the kids basically scattered, because everybody was damaged to some extent. So everybody scattered and went their own way. My dad, at, again, 9 years old, with his hand almost entirely blown off, and shrapnel in his eye, in his left eye, he had to walk miles to get home, to let his mother know what had happened. She, and with the help of, some cousins and some other relatives, she got him on a mule. And they got him down to the ferry that crosses the Ohio River so that they could get to the big town of Portsmouth at that time, where there was an actual hospital. And so at 9 years old, this is what he experienced. And so, you know, he's a person who has who's been real up close to death on many occasions. That one story starting when he was 9 years old, but I could go on with stories like that forever. And I could enhance that story more by telling the details that of all the events of that day. But for this purpose, I could tell a number of tales similar to that about my dad where he stood nose to nose with death and didn't blink. So when I say he had a very realistic outlook on life and death, I really mean that. But like I said, I'm not going to spend today talking about my dad as much as I'd love to do that. I had trying to go through my notes and try to figure out everything that I was going to talk about today. I ran across an old email question that someone had sent me that I made notes on it, and then it sort of slipped my mind, and I never got around to addressing it. And I don't even know how old this is. This could be weeks or months. I have no idea how old this was, but it came from Nathan, and he asked, "Hey Ben, I have a question you might be able to address." He says, "I was wondering about government subsidies and how they affect the market. How come sometimes a product being subsidized lowers the price, like corn, and other times the subsidies make prices go higher, like in college?" And this is a good question, and I really intended to answer this a long time ago, but really to address this, you have to break it down a little bit, and you have to realize that there's really two questions you need to ask. One is, who's being subsidized? Is it the buyer or the seller? And the other question is, are there price controls as a factor in this? So when you think about higher education, there are no absolute price controls that really take place, and the subsidies go to both the buyer and the seller. So now I'll touch more on that a little bit later, because I have something to compare that to. But in the case of corn, you have price fixing through several methods. There's federal mandates on things like how much corn is turned into ethanol for ethanol production. And how much corn is grown through corn growing quotas and through direct subsidies to farmers to overproduce corn. And you also have tariffs and price controls on import exports like that. Some people will argue that tariffs are not price controls, But really they are. I mean, a buyer will only pay a certain amount for something. And if you place enough of a tariff on it in either direction, import or export, then you're creating a situation where the buyer won't buy it. And so you're forced then to lower the price to a level of where that the buyer will buy it, even with the tariff involved. So in a sense, tariffs very much are price controls. It's just a little bit more complicated than your typical, the way you usually think of price controls. So, also affecting the price of corn is how much of that corn is converted to high fructose corn syrup. And through the price controls on the dairy industry and the sugar industry and the sugar tariffs. And that may not seem obvious, but if you consider that every dairy cow in the dairy industry, well, I shouldn't say every, there are some dairies that grass feed their cattle and have very healthy milk production and things like that. But most of the really big dairy production operations use lots of corn. And since all the dairy prices are fixed, the dairy prices are fixed, and since a lot of the factors in the dairy industry are heavily regulated and heavily controlled by the government, then you have a major buyer of corn with a fixed window of price that they have to work within. So that also affects the corn price in a sort of a secondary way, but very dramatically, because like I was saying about the tariffs, the buyer can only pay a certain amount for anything. Doesn't matter what the product is. And if through price manipulations, whether they be taxation or any other kind of price manipulation, if you drive that price outside of that window, then the buyer simply can't buy that product. So for that reason, the dairy industry is heavily regulated as it is. Has a massive influence on the corn industry, at least on the prices of the corn industry. And with the sugar industry, it's a little bit different because, there are all kind, again, sugar industry is heavily regulated, and there are some really nifty, nifty? No, that's not the right word. Nasty? Yeah. There are some really nasty price controls through tariffs on the sugar industry. So this with all the other, price manipulations in the corn industry, this causes a preference to be in the market for high fructose corn syrup rather than the higher priced sugar. So that puts pressure on manufacturers of, high fructose corn syrup to overproduce that, in order to compete and take over the sugar markets, which it's not hard for them to do considering the price advantages that they have. And also with corn, a lot of the direct subsidies go to the original seller, the grower, encouraging him to constantly overproduce. This will visibly drive the corn prices down. That's what you see on the market, that the corn prices are artificially low because of all the direct subsidies to the growers. But a lot of the subsidies in the corn industry go to product handlers after the grower sells it. Companies just consider one company, Archer Daniel Midland's. James Bovard did a study for the Cato Institute some years ago, and he concluded that, and this is his quote, Archer Daniel Midland's has indirectly cost Americans tens of billions of dollars in higher prices and higher taxes. And then he goes on to say, at least 43% of ADM's annual profits are from products heavily subsidized or protected by the American government. Moreover, for every $1 of profits earned by ADM's corn sweetener operation, it costs consumers $10. That's crazy. For every $1 in profit that Archer Daniels Midland's earns from their corn sweetener operation, it costs consumers $10. And then James goes on to say, for every $1 of profit earned by ADM's bioethanol operation, it costs taxpayers $30. Archer Daniels Midland Corporate, a company, converts corn into ethanol. And this is heavily subsidized by the federal government. And there are mandates in place requiring that certain percentages of the corn market be turned into ethanol. And so all this together creates a situation that, for, like he was saying, for every $1 of profit ADM makes, it costs the consumers $30. Now, and keep in mind, this is an old study. This James Bovard did this study looking at the period of time from 1980 to 1995. And also remember that this doesn't include the cost of maintaining the bloated bureaucracy that regulates, oversees, inspects, investigates, taxes, and enforces all this silliness on the industry. So I don't even know if it would be possible to accurately discover all the hidden costs involved in the farm subsidies industry. And all this means that corn prices and the prices of corn-based products are artificially cheaper than they should be. But in the long run, we pay far more because of all the bureaucracy and the price distortions. And that's what he's talking about there. For every dollar that the ADM earns, it costs us about $10 for in the corn sweetener division, or, you know, $40 or $30 in the bioethanol division. In a completely different way of looking at it, think about ice cream, for example. Now, ice cream is affected by both the corn industry and the sugar tariffs and the sugar industry, and by the dairy industry. It's affected by the corn industry in two different ways. First off, the obvious is that the use of high fructose corn syrup becomes dramatically cheaper to add than the falsely high priced sugar. So the ice cream manufacturer is given an incentive here to use high fructose corn syrup rather than sugar. And that decision is distorted, you know, by both the intentionally overpriced sugar market and the intentionally underpriced corn syrup market. And I'm not going to get into a big difference between high fructose corn syrup and other sweeteners and how, you know, fructose is utilized in the liver and can be very damaging under certain circumstances, like in high fructose corn syrup, and where other sweeteners are utilized through other organs rather than the liver, and they don't have that same effect. I'm not going to get into a whole thing on that today. You can research that out on your own, or maybe I can do an article one day. Oh, you know what? Oh, I have an announcement that I forgot. I meant to put it in right from the beginning. After the commercial break, I'll have an announcement. I just had that thought. So after the commercial break, I'll have an announcement. And it looks like we're going to have a commercial break now anyway. So I'm going to have to pick up after the commercial and finish what I was talking about with ice cream and how it's distorted, how the price of ice cream is distorted, and even what's put in ice cream is distorted by this. So I'll be right back. Stick with me.
I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge. Real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much. Would you like to do something to support badquaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to badquaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break there. Now, I was talking about, I almost did it again. I was going to just take right off talking about ice cream. So here's the big announcement. And I teased with this in a couple of different locations, including on the BadQuaker.com website. But then if you're a subscriber to the feed at BadQuaker.com, and there's two different ways to subscribe. You can subscribe to the podcast or you can subscribe to the page itself. And if you're a subscriber to the page at BadQuaker.com, then you will have gotten an alert yesterday that I put something up there. And if you followed that alert and went over and read what was put up, then you already know what I'm about to say. And that is that the Bad Quaker Forum is now alive and active, and you can go there. You can go to the forum. You can find the link on today's show notes, but basically it's badquaker.com/forum/, and then you just hit enter and it'll go right there to it. So what's the deal with the forum? Okay. So if you don't log into the forum, if you're just as a visitor, a guest or whatever, and you can just roll through and look, you can look at a good portion of it without logging in or anything. And you can kind of get an idea of what's there. We've been playing around with it, and there may be some bugs in it still. There may be some flaws. So we're more than open to suggestions on all this. But without logging in, you can go over and look it all over. If you decide to make a login, you have to come up with a username and a password, and you it requires that you give it an email address. But we will keep that very private. We won't let anybody abuse your email. Unless a hacker gets in, then we're all dead. You know how that goes. Well, we're not dead, but anyway. So you can just make a profile, and then once you make a profile, you can see a little bit more of the forum than you can if you don't have a profile. If you're just a visitor of the forum, there's a few there's parts of it that are hidden from you. But once you make a profile, then you can see those extra parts of the forum, and you can look around and you can post. Visitors are not allowed to post, but if you make a profile, you can post. And you can interact. And I've been talking about this a little bit for a while. I'm planning on spending far less time doing things like on Facebook and other places on the internet. And I'm going to try to focus more of my just random posting and thoughts and things like that. I'm going to focus more of those on that forum. So if you like the podcast and you'd like to interact a little bit, on a one-to-one level, either with some of the listeners or with me, or with some of the Bad Quaker staff is going to be on there also, then the forum's going to be a really good way to do that. And if you're friends with me on Facebook, or if you follow the BadQuaker.com Facebook page, there's probably going to be a lot less activity there, as we focus more of our attention to the forum. So, and then there's one other thing about the forum. Actually, there's two other things about the forum. If you'd like to donate to support the podcast and the website and the forum and so forth, there's a donate button right on the header, right in the like top center as you look at the page. There's a donate button there, and you can donate. And in addition to that, and being totally separate from that, if you'd like to be a paying member on the forum, then once you make a profile, if you go into your profile and into the settings in your profile, you'll see across the top the buttons. There's a forum posting explaining how to do this, but you can go into your profile and you can become a supporting member, and this only costs $4 a month to become a supporting member. Or if you want, you can buy a full year for $25, so that saves you a little bit. Now, here's the big announcement. I've said all that to say this. Here's the big announcement. We decided that for the first 10 people who log on, make a profile, and then become a supporting member and buy a full year, then for the first 10 supporting members who have paid for a full year, we're going to send them a free badquaker.com t-shirt. And so here's the funny part. We put that up on the website yesterday, and we've already had a few people that have logged on and done that. So I'm extending it out from the time that this podcast, so we're going to give free t-shirts to those people who have already logged on and got, paid, you know, as supporting members. We're already going to send them t-shirts. But in addition to all those, when this podcast goes live and we publish it today, then from that point, the next 10 will also get free t-shirts. And we're going to do this, you know, right now we have a good selection of sizes, but as the supply goes down, we may be limited on our size choices. So the quicker you get in there and the quicker that you make the profile and buy a year's subscription, then the higher you'll be on that list, the more likely you'll get a choice of sizes. That way, you know, if you're a small, you won't get stuck only having a triple X size. Or if you're very large, like me, then you won't be stuck with a small size to give away to some kid somewhere. So if you have an interest in the forum, get over there, badquaker.com/forum/, and you can look around and see if you like it. And if you have an interest in supporting badquaker.com, there's two ways. There's through a direct donation, through that donation button, and there's a way through becoming a supporting member for only $4 a month or $25 a year. Okay, and I should say, and this is explained in the forum post on this topic, you can also use alternative currencies, silver, bitcoins. There's a variety of ways we can do this. So get over there and check it out. That was supposed to be the big announcement that I was going to make right in the beginning, and I forgot about it. So here it is in the middle. So now let's get back to talking about ice cream, because who doesn't want to talk about ice cream, really? I mean, if, you know, you sit around and you say, hey, let's talk about ice cream. Who would not want to talk about ice cream? But let's see. Okay, so I was talking about ice cream being the ice cream industry is distorted by corn subsidies in a variety of different ways. So, for example, the ice cream manufacturer is going to have a tendency to use, he's going to want to use high fructose corn syrup rather than real sugar because of the price distortions in both the sugar and the corn market. And then in addition to that, the price of butterfat, the cream that's used in the ice cream, the price of that is distorted because of all the intrusion into the entire dairy market by the government, but also by the fact that the vast bulk of these really big dairy corporations, the vast bulk of them feed their cattle almost entirely corn, which, you know, really is not natural for a cow to eat. If you look at a cow out in a field, he's not just eating the tops, the tassels off of grass. He's eating grass. And so, corn is really an extremely hybridized grass. That's really what corn is. And in the case of genetically modified corn, you've got a highly hybridized grass that's now genetically modified with things like fish DNA and insect DNA and things like this. So this is not at all a natural diet for a cow. But when you take that cow and you feed it something that is completely outside of its natural diet, and then it overproduces milk the way that the modern dairy cow overproduces milk. Wow, that's a scary topic that I didn't want to get into. So let's walk away from that. So the ice cream market is entirely distorted. So you pay far more for ice cream than you would under other circumstances. So the corn is cheaper, the corn syrup is cheaper, but other products like ice cream are distorted in the other direction. Ice cream, you know, cream is almost a byproduct of the in a normal setting, cream is almost a byproduct of the milk industry. In old days, in the farming days of old, you know, excessive cream would kind of be a problem for you, for a dairy. So they would have to figure out new ways to come up with it. That's why we have cheese. That's why we have butter. That's why we have ice cream. That's why we have cottage cheese. That's why we have all these different cream-based products because there was an abundance of cream. And in a natural setting, without a government, you know, interference, cream products, cream-based products would be much cheaper than they are. But that's not the case with the interference that the government does. The government makes really, really cheap milk. It makes milk cheaper than it naturally would be, but it makes the cream far more expensive. So actually it provides an incentive for the dairy industry to make really expensive stuff out of cream and then give you cheap milk that's been stripped of all of its value. So again, this is to a large extent due to the interference in the dairy industry, but it's also due to the interference in the corn industry. So cheap corn is dumped not only on the American market, but this cheap corn is dumped on the international markets as well. And when they get this cheap corn, now I was talking about all the hidden costs that we have to pay, the bureaucracy, the subsidies, all that stuff, the taxes that support the subsidies, all the layers and layers and layers of bureaucrats that do all the nonsense that go with all this. And so all those people have to be paid, and they're all paid by, you know, either direct taxation or through some type of hidden taxation or extortion of some form that the American taxpayers pay for all of that whole industry. And then, so the result of that, and then you have this cheap corn, and you dump this cheap corn on the international market. So other people in other countries get the benefit of having super cheap corn that the American taxpayers have subsidized and have paid for all the levels of bureaucracy and all the taxation that goes with it and all the tariffs and everything else that goes on. The American people have had to pay for all that so that the rest of the world can get super, super cheap corn. So we're literally taxed to feed the world cheap GMO corn. Think about that for a minute. You're taxed so that people in other countries can have cheap American GMO corn. And also consider that foreign farmers are not receiving all those subsidies. So they can't compete with this cheap corn. I've talked before about poor farmers in Mexico losing their farms and being evicted from their farms because they couldn't pay their bills, and having their farms taken by the government, or being forced to sell their farms at really low, below market rates to companies like Archer Daniels Midland and other companies, because they couldn't afford to work their own farms. And the reason why is because the corn market is so distorted. And so foreign farmers are then pushed off of their farms. And so what do? They have to eat. They have to feed their families. What's their choices? Well, they can come to America and become illegal alien and farm workers. They can do that. Or they can go into the cities in their own countries. And that drives the factory worker, the wages of the factory workers, it drives the factory workers' wages down. Because there's an abundance of these farmers coming in, and, you know, different people from the farming communities that can't make a living out there. They're all pouring into the cities in these foreign countries. And so that puts an abundance of cheap labor on the market. So that creates all these cheap factory workers in foreign countries. And of course, their wages would be lower anyway, but this just makes it worse on them, and it makes it, you know, it provides an incentive for American companies then to have more and more of their manufacturing done overseas. So it's this giant loop. Just by giving farmers free money and influencing the corn market like this, it creates layers and layers and layers in society of problems. And not only in the American society, but all around the world. It distorts all kinds of things that the idiot politician that makes up these laws doesn't have the intelligence to even wrap his tiny little greedy brain around. Now, I was talking about, you know, how that affects higher education earlier, how these subsidies and so forth affect higher education earlier. And I said I'd get back to that topic. So let's get back to the schools. But in a kind of a roundabout way, I want to talk about gift cards. And now I'm going to use Applebee's, the restaurant Applebee's, as an example, just so I have a word to fill in. But really, this can be anything. It can be McDonald's gift cards. It can be Sears gift cards. It could be anything. But I'll use Applebee's as an example. So here's the scenario you have. Grandma likes to go to Applebee's in the afternoon. She doesn't go during, you know, the rush hours because it's too noisy and there's too many people and everything. So she goes, like around 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Her and her, several old lady friends like to go down to Applebee's, and three of them can have a nice afternoon, meal. For them, it's a meal. It's just the appetizers and so forth. But for them, they can have, you know, they can feed three of these old ladies for around $20 at Applebee's. And it's pretty nice for them. They like it. And so one day, grandma's thinking, well, I need to buy Sonny a gift, her college age grandson, you know? And so she thinks, she sees the little sign there at the checkout, at the Applebee's checkout. She says, oh, look at this. I can buy him an Applebee's gift card. And, I'm sure he'll like that. So Grandma buys Sonny a $20 Applebee's gift card. Now, the thing of it is, Sonny doesn't normally go to Applebee's for whatever reason. There's not one near his campus, or, you know, it's not the cool place for him to be in his group, or, you know, whatever. It's too expensive. Applebee's is not cheap. Yeah, although it's not super expensive either. But if you're a college student, yeah, Applebee's is on the higher end. So, well, I suppose it's according to how rich your dad is and what kind of college student you are. But anyway, so Sonny gets his gift card from Grammy, and he's like, all right, let's go to Applebee's. So he grabs a friend. They take off to Applebee's. Now, a college kid going to Applebee's with a $20 gift certificate doesn't mean he's going to spend $20. It means he and his friend are going to go to Applebee's. And they're going to use that $20 gift certificate, that gift card, and they're probably going to spend closer to $40, because by the time they both have a drink and they both have an appetizer and they both have an entree and then they both have another drink and maybe one or both of them have a dessert, then you're looking closer to $40 than you are $20. Now, Applebee's bets on this. That's why all these companies like these gift cards so much, because they know it's going to be attractive to people. Some people it's just going to be regular customers that get them and use them, and that's fine. Applebee's doesn't lose anything if you buy it for $20 and they use it for $20. You know, there's no downside to that. But in many cases, the gift card is given to somebody who doesn't frequent that business quite as often. So it's a way to pull in people who wouldn't normally shop there or wouldn't normally visit that restaurant or whatever. And that's why these gift cards are so attractive. And as a matter of fact, knowing that the average person is going to spend far more than the gift card by itself, knowing this, the companies that push these gift cards can actually offer them cheaper than the face value. So when Granny is there checking out at the, paying her bill or whatever, she looks over and sees the card and maybe it's on sale. Maybe she can buy an Applebee's gift card that's worth $20, and maybe she can buy it for like $15 because it's on sale. Well, who wouldn't want to take that deal? I mean, who wouldn't want to say, I'll give you $15 and you give me $20. That's a great deal. So Granny grabs it. She buys the $20 card for $15 and she gives it to her son. But even if she has to pay full price for it, there's still an incentive there for everybody to use these gift cards. So Sonny gets the gift card. He's happy about it. He goes to Applebee's. He ends up spending $40. So now Applebee's has got their initial $20 that they knew that they would get one way or the other. They've also got the extra business that they would not have gotten some other way. And Sonny got, you know, $20 worth of free food. So everybody's happy. Grandma gets the wonderful effect, the feelings that come with doing something nice for somebody. Everybody involved profits from this in one way or the other. Now, when I come back from this break, I'm going to explain what about gift cards is like college and what about gift cards is not like college. Stick with me. I'll be right back.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial there. Okay, so now how are Arby's gift cards like college? And how are they not like college? Well, that's where we're at. Okay, college is like gift cards in the sense that the buyer is incentivized to spend. Remember, Sonny gets something that he didn't have before. And so he not only has an incentive to spend the free money that he got from Grandma, but he also has an incentive to spend his own money in the course of that. Because now, let's say if he gets $20 worth of food from Applebee's, then he gets that free. But if he buys $25 worth of food, he essentially bought $25 worth of food for $5. So he's much more likely to buy $25 worth of food for $5, you know, considering his $20 free he got from Grandma, than he is to hold on to that $5 or use that $5 in any other way. So there's an incentive there not only for him to use the free money that Grandma gave him, but it actually incentivizes him to spend $5 that he would not have normally spent. And it might, and that formula just goes on out further. So he's more likely to spend $30 with Grandma's $20 free. That means he only spent $10 to get $30 worth of goods. So he still has an incentive to do that. And all the way up, I mean, to any amount, the formula still remains. Now, at some point, he's gonna hit a level where he just doesn't want to spend that much money. So whether that's at $25 or $35 or $55 or $100, whatever the level is for him personally, that he reaches. But either way, that $20 from Grandma, that free $20, incentivizes him to go ahead and spend money that he wouldn't have spent otherwise. So now, that's the way with college. When there are incentives to the buyer, that's the student, there are incentives to the buyer to go to college in the form of grants from the government and subsidized loans that make the loans easier to get and cheaper to get than they would be in a true free market. So because of these different incentives like this, then the student is encouraged, economically speaking, to not only go to college, but is more encouraged to do that than they would be if there were no subsidies. Now, in addition to subsidies through the buyer, well, I'll go into that in a minute. So the college is very much like a gift card in the sense that the buyer is incentivized not only to spend, but to spend more than they normally would. Now, a way that a college is not like a gift card is because there's a limit on how many gift cards that Grandma can afford to give away. Grandma is not the Federal Reserve, and Grandma is not Congress. Grandma doesn't have an unlimited purse that just goes on forever, and Grandma doesn't steal from other people to get her money. So Grandma has limitations as to how many cards she can give to, what did I call him, Skippy? I can't remember what I called the kid. Sonny. There we go. So Grandma's limited on how much money she can give to Sonny. But the Federal Reserve and Congress and the aspects of government that are printing money and that are creating, debt and that are pushing student loans on everybody, there's no limit to their pockets. They can just continue to give away money and give away money and give away money. So, that means that in that sense, it's not like, the gift card is not like college because there's no limit on how much the college, how much distortion takes place with that buyer incentive. Remember with Sonny, I was saying that there's some limit there. He's gonna get to some point where, whether that's $25 or $35 or whatever, he's gonna get to a point of where he says, okay, that's all, because I only got 20 from grandma. But that never takes place in the college setting. There's this incentive to just keep getting another loan and going back to school again. Because as long as you're in school, you don't have to start paying back the loan. And you can continue getting more and more grants and more loans. So there's this incentive to spend far more than you normally would. So really what we're looking at is that money is of less value when there's more of it. When there's more money available to the buyer, whether that subsidy comes from grandma or whether it comes from the government. When there's more money available to the buyer, the money is of less value to the buyer. And you know, Sonny's more likely to spend it. But if grandma continues dumping gift cards on people, then Applebee's would be encouraged to raise their prices since there's more money being spent more freely. And people would be willing to pay those higher prices because, hey, they're getting free money from grandma. The free grandma dollars encourage people to spend even if the prices are going up. So thinking of Sonny again, you know, if Sonny's getting a card every week from grandma, if grandma's worried, well, I don't know if Sonny's getting enough good food with him being off at school like that. And so she's sending him a gift card every week for Applebee's for $20. Well, first off, grandma might want to check and see how many of those grandma bucks are actually going for food and how many are going for drinks. But above and beyond that, you're creating an incentive here, not only for Sonny to regularly go in and spend more and more and more at Applebee's, you're actually creating an encouragement for Applebee's to raise their price because they get accustomed to all this new money coming in. So what we see here is when the buyer is subsidized, the price is driven up. But when the buyer is subsidized, it also drives the quality down. For example, if the manager at Applebee's, and I'm not picking, let's not have any silly lawsuits here, so I'm not picking on some manager at Applebee's, but this is an economic principle. If the manager at the Applebee's understands that it doesn't matter what kind of crap he puts out, Sonny's still going to come in and spend his free money. You see, so he's less worried about how clean the floors are. He's less worried about how good the food tastes. He's less worried about how quickly that the waiters and the waitresses attend to the customers. He's less worried about that because he's got this grandma money coming in one way or the other. Sonny's not going to take his Applebee's gift certificate over to the Steak and Shake or whatever, because it's of no value to him. So he's coming back no matter what kind of crap the Applebee's is putting out. Well, that's kind of the same with colleges too. So when the buyer is subsidized, he becomes less frugal and more likely to spend more on a lesser product. The seller is incentivized to raise prices and lower the quality of the product. The seller is incentivized to look for more ways to funnel the subsidies to himself by appealing to grandma and less incentivized to appeal to the customer with lower prices and higher quality. Grandma becomes the true customer. You see how that works? Even though Sonny's coming in to spend the grandma bucks, the real source, the real customer is grandma. So college is incentivized not to produce the next Louis Pasteur, but to produce as many professional students as possible to keep the government money flowing. And the result is a glut of highly schooled but unskilled workers on the market. This drives wages for college grads down. It creates an incentive for the graduate to go back to school for more for a more impressive degree. It's a never-ending loop that drives the economy in the opposite direction than it should. So it's just like those price distortions in the corn market, except what you have is you have incentives in the college built in this loop that incentivize the college to produce poor product and really worry about meeting the needs of the student far less than it would if there were none of these incentives. And it creates a situation where the student, maybe not openly in their mind, but the student has these incentives to stay in college no matter whether they're getting anything good out of it or not. They're encouraged to run up as much debt as possible and stay in college. Because, like I said, as long as you're a full-time student, you don't have to pay your loans back. You can just keep building up more and more debt. And so who really is pushing the college, higher education in this situation? Is it really just the schools wanting to push more and more, you know, wanting more and more government money? Sure. I mean, who doesn't like money? They want money. The colleges want money. But really, who's the government money going to? Who's the real customer? It's not really the school, and it's not really the student. Who's the real customer? It's the banks. The banks don't care if you get an education or not. The banks don't care if the school fails or if it doesn't fail. But the banks are being subsidized by the government to keep the students in school as long as possible and keep that debt building up bigger and bigger and bigger. Because really, who runs everything? The colleges don't run anything. The students don't have any power. Even the parents have very little power. They think they have power with the vote, but we all know that's a joke. So who's really the customer here, and who's really being subsidized? Who does upper education really profit? And it all goes back to the banks. It's this giant never-ending loop. And the more of it that they do, the worse the situation gets. Now, schools are also subsidized in a completely different way, and I should mention this as well. Let me hit pricing first. Okay, so how does this affect the pricing of the schools? Well, just like Applebee's, with the free money flowing in, the student is far less concerned about the individual price of the product that he's buying, the education. He's far less concerned about that because a good portion of the money is free. Or he's pushed through these other market pressures to remain in school because if he goes out, he's going to have nothing but a low-paying job, or he's going to have to compete with a lot of other people who have just the same exact degree as he's got. So he has these incentives to stay in school no matter what the cost is and no matter how good or how bad the product is. So this allows the school then to say, well, if the money's going to flow no matter what kind of crap we put out, then let's put out the cheapest crap possible. And what is the college then really looking for? Of course they're looking for money, but where's the market money coming from? Not the free money from grandma, not the government money, but where's the real market driven money? Well, oddly enough, that starts to come in from sports. And so the college is given more financial incentives, specifically by things like, ticket prices for sporting events, advertising fees and this kind of thing for sporting events, and also from alumni taking pride in the fact that their school is in the Big Ten or whatever. So there's a huge financial incentive to the college to produce not better education, but a more active sports program. So, for instance, I saw this college student, a football player. I saw him on TV over the weekend, and he was talking about a debate that he had with his fellow college football players as to whether West Virginia was a state or not. And this is a career college person, and he didn't. And there was some level of debate about whether or not West Virginia was a state. And that's what the colleges are producing. They're producing athletes of amazing quality because, you know, the government doesn't really do a whole lot of subsidizing athletics. They do some through, secondary support through the college and so forth and the other grants and everything that are available for students. But the real incentive for the colleges, whether on the university level or lower, the real incentive there is to produce athletes. And they do that very efficiently. and they get paid directly on how good of an athlete they put out. So again, we're not putting out Louis Pasteur's here. We're putting out O.J. Simpson's. Ooh, that's a bad thought. Maybe I should have used a different football player. But either way, this is what we're doing. This is what the college is incentivized to do. And of course, there's with all this money flowing in, whether from the sports programs, or whether it's free money coming in from the government, since there's no limit to it, since grandma doesn't have an end to her purse, then there's no reason for the college to lower its prices or compete in prices or, you know, in any other way, try to produce a better product or, and this is where online colleges are really kind of revolutionary in this process. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of government disruptions in the market, a lot of government distortions. But in many ways, the online colleges have this really big advantage if your purpose is to get a better education and not spend 4 or 6 or more years hanging out with your friends at Applebee's living off of grandma's money. If you're really wanting an education, then with the advent of the internet, I don't know why a person would want to go off to a college and pay the kind of money to get into debt that you're going to have to pay and then put yourself into a position where you owe all this vast amounts of college, school loans and so forth. And then go into a market that's bloated with other college graduates that have the same degree that you have and try to compete with them. And of course, then, on the same topic, you're also losing all those productive years that you could be working a job and making money. That's another loss to going to the old style colleges rather than an online thing. Because in many cases, you can get the same education or a better education online. I've said a few times here, especially lately in talking about it, I probably have more lecture time and more actual book reading on the topic of economics than most economic grad students. And almost all that came through the Mises Institute, or other Austrian economists through their lectures and through their books and so forth. I don't have any kind of certification or any kind of graduation, paperwork of any kind. I don't have any fancy letters to put behind my name, but I could probably sit down. Well, I have on this podcast, actually. I've talked to Bob Murphy. I've talked to Bob Higgs. I've talked to Jeffrey Tucker. I've talked to, I don't even know. I'm leaving other economists out of the question here. I've talked to, people with doctorate degrees, professors of economics, and I can speak with them on a peer level on pretty much any aspect of economics, not because I ever attended a single class, but because I went to Mises.org and I just downloaded every audio file that I could get my paws on and every free book that I could get my paws on. And I spent, all that time just out of sheer curiosity and the desire to learn economics. I spent all that time at Mises.org, for free, learning all that stuff. Now, and the advantage to Mises.org, for them rather, is that caused me to have the interest in actually buying some books too, so that I could have them here to hold and look at and to give to other people. So, that's kind of off the topic, but that kind of thing can really bring a free market back into education like it should be. But so there, just to wrap up, that's how the corn subsidies create low corn prices. Of course, we pay for those low corn prices 10 or 15 or 30 times over in other taxes and other prices of other products. And it creates a bloated price structure in higher education, because the universities, the colleges, have no incentive to be competitive and to lower the prices. They just have a never-ending stream of grandma money coming in from the government, and so they have no motive whatsoever to be frugal in any way or to compete in any way. So that's why corn is cheap and education is expensive. When in reality, you think about it, sure, corn should be cheap because really, pretty much any farm product should be pretty cheap nowadays with all the modern equipment that we have and so forth. Food should be pretty cheap in an open and free market, but education should be really cheap in an open and free market. But we don't have an open free market, and we haven't had an open or free market in a very long time. But folks, that's going to change. You know it will. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening today. And don't forget to get over to the forum and make yourself a profile and get in there and post something fun and post something interesting. Thank you very much, folks. Goodbye.